of Henry Hoyle, known as Harry, at 26 Highfield Road, Enfield, on the 5th of July, 1999. All right, now then, where were you born?
Dry Dock Farm, Durr, and Shuttleworth.
And were your parents tenants of the farm?
Yes. When I arrived on the earth, I already had two sisters, obviously older than me, and I was the first boy. And then 2 years later, another boy arrived, that was Jim. And then 2 years later, another girl arrived, so that was five of us, you see. And my mother stayed at home, obviously, and my father worked for the gas board in Stubbins, when they were the gas place at Stubbins, opposite the corner pin there. And we lived there until 1923.
Did he farm the farm as well as being working at the gas?
No, it was just sort of we lived in the premises. And that's why we had to leave it eventually. My father was always into poultry, and he had lots of hen pens in the field behind. And in 1923, the farmer was the next farm top of the Lee. He owned the dry gap, and his son was getting married. So, of course, obviously, he needed accommodation, and we had to leave. And my poor parents were absolutely distraught.
So how long had they been there?
From being just after they were married. So they'd been married about, I don't know, because Betty's 6 years older than me, so I should think 8 or 9 years, perhaps 10 years, I don't know. But I'm not sure about that. And so we had to leave there, you see. And eventually that's how we arrived at the little shop in Rochester Road. It was called the little shop, but there was four bedrooms, because it had been two cottages, you see. But I suppose the shop was only little, really, and that's how it got its name. But it was a very good... My mother was a hard-working woman. Not a lovable person for us, but a very, very good mother, you know.
A good provider.
Good provider and an extremely good worker. And she was a good mum, and the shop was a success, you know. A lot of things at the shop, you know, because it was next door to Bridge Mills, which was a very, very successful weaving mill in those days. And my mother eventually started... There was no canteens in the mill then. There was just a steam kettle and a great big black iron oven. That was just inside the yard, where they could go and brew up or whatever. So my mother decided to start making dinners for them, you see. And that was a great success. And I've told this story many times. There was steak and onions and boiled potatoes, and that was sixpence. Potato pie on another day was fourpence, you see. Meat pie and peas on a Friday, which was a mystery to me, because we were Catholics, and we weren't allowed meat in those days. But eventually I discovered why, you know, when I got a bit older, of course. And we children went in the shop in the morning and took their names and put it on a piece of paper and put it in the dish. And then they came to the place at lunchtime. And
they called in on the way, or did they come out?
They called in, and they came in on the way down at morning and left the dish. You know, we were open early.
What time was that?
They started at 7:30, so between 7 and 8. And we used to do it in turns with my mum, you know. We were very happy and we had a very nice family life, you know.
Can you describe the shop?
Yeah, well, it was a general... We sold everything from baking to butter to sugar to Beecham spools and everything you can imagine. My father was a good worker, but he was a very handy man. And he made all sorts of... The shop was very run down when we went into it. But he put shelves up and cupboards up, and we decorated, you know, the place was decorated, and it was really nice. And it was just like going in an Aladdin's cave, because you couldn't ask for the wrong thing.
What did you think a room as this?
Something like this, for sure. Perhaps just a little bit bigger.
Was so the shop. Like, maybe 14 feet by 20
yeah,
feet.
Something like that. Yeah.
Was it a one counter? Or?
Yeah, only just one little counter just inside the door, and just an ordinary house window, but when it was set out like a shop window, you see, you know. And we Marmol just sold everything, you know. Said a wood barge were five for tuppence.
Where did you do the cooking?
Where? In the kitchen. We had an enormous kitchen, very, very big. Just to give you an idea of the size, my father went to sales a lot, and one day he came home with a three-quarter size billiard table, and we could get it in the kitchen, no problem. And Jim and I, that was my brother, we'd grown up a bit by that time. We used to carry this thing in and put it on the table on a Friday, and it stayed there over the weekend. And all the kids round about, all our friends, in those days, of course, they didn't go out on a Sunday night. All the kids were around. We had a piano in the front room, the old-fashioned way, I suppose. We had a sing-song on a Sunday night, and we had a few games of snooker, billiards.
Was it billiards or snooker?
Well, both. There was both. Oh. Yeah. And we had some, wonderful memories, haven't we?
Was your father still working at the gasworks?
Oh, yes, yes. He worked until he started being ill when he was about 60. And he was like myself, he had a bad heart. And he had to give up work, you know.
What did he do at the gasworks?
He was a boilerman and yard foreman. Yeah. Yeah. It was quite a big place, was the gasworks. Yeah. We didn't have a bath at the house. And on Rochester the road, of course, when we went in it. But when my dad worked at the gasworks, they had a big, great big iron bath down there, you see. And on the weekends, the children, we used to take his dinner in a basket down to the mill on a Saturday and a Sunday. And and then we get in this big bath, you see, from this big bath full of that. And these fellows that worked there, they were rough. Oh, they were rough. It was an awful job. On the stack, what we call on the stack. They were stripped to the waist and they were, it was horrendously hot when they emptied the retorts, you know. And they used to go, when they'd done their shift, they were straight across the road into the corner thing. And when they came back, I can remember the names of quite a number of these people. And they used to come in and they'd have had a good few drinks. And they'd come in the bathroom and they'd be floating us into that. How can they go?
So how old would he be at this stage?
About 12, you know. About 10 or 12 year olds. 12, 13, 14, you know. And we knew all these chaps. They were rough fellows, but they were good workers.
Where was the gas work?
It was right. As you stop at the traffic lights, if you notice, as you go, just as you start to go through the traffic lights, there's some wooden gates there. There's the Cuba, the Cuba Industrial Estate. Well, it was off the site. That was Terminals and Stockdale's mill, of course, in those days. And the gasworks was just off the side. And there was a little row of houses where the entrance to Cuba is now. And the owner manager and somebody else lived in these little cottages, which backed onto the gasworks. Just as you went through the gates, there were two gasometers. And then you went through the yard where all the machinery was and everything, right over to the river runs down the back there, well, and right down the back of there was two more gasometers. And my father used to have the job of transferring the gas, one of his jobs, from one holder to another. And they had great big wheels on the ground. And of course we used to do this, you see, he used to take us along them, and then turn that until it, and you'd see it slowly come down to the bottom, you see. And of course, years later, when I was working, I actually painted these damn things. Great big anger, you know. That was all right, you had to climb up to do then. But the holders, they used to get them about 6 to 8 foot high, and we'd do that portion on the top, and then they'd take it a bit further up, you see. And let it dry, and then do that, and then up again, and do that. Yeah, I worked quite a few times on the gas holders.
And was there coal nearby?
Yeah, there was coal. The coal came on the railway line, because there was two railway lines then, wasn't there? Accrington and Baker, you see. And then the wagons used to come and they'd stop. Sort of, as you go around the latch to go into Orgeron Rotterdam, on the top there, they'd stop there and tip. And it went into the gasworks, you see, down the chute. And then it went into the retorts. They fed it into the retorts on a, like a little shovel. Like
a gravity fed then from the top?
Yes, and they had like little buckets on a
conveyor belt.
And that conveyed it into there, you see. But the worst part was when they took it out, because it was all cork, you see. Came out as cork. They pushed a great big iron thing on a caterpillar track. And that went right through and pushed all this absolutely red hot cork out onto the far side. And they were there with the buckets of water, you see.
What was it onto? Was it onto a
big iron, big concrete floors, you know?
Yes.
Not concrete floors, iron floors.
Yeah.
As high as this room, you know, and they used to throw buckets of water on till it would cool down, and then they buried it away, see. I mean, they didn't even have a stacker truck in those days, and it was all wheelbarrow stuff. And people used to go and get a great big bag of cork for shilling, you see. As big as, it didn't matter how big the bag was, they filled it for you, see.
Oh.
And people went with their little trucks because they couldn't afford coal, they couldn't have water things.
What was coal? Coke was a shilling, how much?
I don't know. I can't remember.
But it was cheaper, wasn't it?
Oh, much cheaper than the coal. In fact, it might have been less than a shilling, but it was, no matter how big the bag was, they always filled it up for you, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd see people going out the road with a little box truck, you know. Yeah.
Did you burn coke at all?
Yeah, well, we had coke. My dad used to get it brought up about 10 or 15 bags. Oh, yes, we burned coke at all.
I mean, was that a perk of the job?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. Oh, we're going back to the cook. We were talking about the cooking at the shop, weren't we? Well, in the kitchen, there was a stove like I've never seen before. The old-fashioned kitchen stove was usually an oven and a boiler, wasn't it? A boiler with the water in, you know, in the little water. Well, this one, which was in when we went in, apparently, it had two ovens. So obviously they must have done some cooking, I should think, in the past, you see. There was an oven on one side and an oven on the other side. So as I was able to, and of course you just pushed the fire under the oven, you know. You built a big fire and then you raked it and pushed it under the oven and it did the cooking, you see. Or kept things hot, you know. Yeah. So I've never seen a stove like it since. I've seen an awful lot with a boiler. And they used to get what they called a ladling can and bring it out into the tin bath, you see, you know.
Were there sandwiches or anything, or they didn't regard those as proper food in those days?
No, I don't ever remember my mother making sandwiches at all, no. She just made these dinners. We had help insofar as, in fact, it was a strange thing because my mother's mother was elderly and she was quite poorly at times, and a great aunt, which was her sister, you see, my mother's great aunt, my mother's auntie, and we had them both living with us for quite a long time. When they were well, they helped. When they weren't well, of course, my mother had to look after them. I mean, there was no nursing homes or, you know, in them days. Unfortunately, they both had to go into what was now Fairfield Hospital, which was Jericho, the workhouse, because they both went mental. But they both came back home. They did very well for them. They both died at home, you know. So, like my mother, you can understand my mother must have worked extremely hard.
What were they sort of sleeping arrangements then?
Well, we had four bedrooms. Yeah.
So
we managed a bedroom. The girls had a bedroom, you see. Mother and Dad had a bedroom. The boys, we had a bedroom. And Grandma and Auntie had a bedroom. So it just worked out very well. And there was a great big landing even then. A massive landing that you could have put two double beds on. And yet they called it a little shop. But of course, there'd been two houses, you see. Yeah, it was happy life. And
What were your parents called?
Sorry?
What were the names of your parents?
Henry and Sarah Ellen. Sarah Ellen was my mum.
What was her name before she was?
She was called Prindle. Sarah Ellen Prindle. Yeah. Her mother was married twice, so she had stepbrothers and sisters. She had only one sister, but she had a stepbrother and a stepsister. They were called Poole.
Mm. And what were your sisters called and brother?
My sister, my elder sister was called Elizabeth. She was called Lizzie. One was Mary Jane, and then myself, and then Jane was James Thomas, and then Kathleen was Catherine. But she's always had Kathleen. She's never had Catherine, I don't know why. And then, strangely enough, we hadn't been at the shop about 2 or 3 years when another girl arrived, which was quite a shock to us. We were getting quite grown up. But we ruined her, I think, because we were big enough to sort of...
How old will you be when she arrived?
Oh, about 13, 14 years old, you see. But we thought she was a little girl, you know. So she's always been the baby of the family. You know, she's not very well at the moment, like she's all of them, but that was the extent of the family then.
So which school did you go to?
I went to Turn School, but only for like half 2 years or something. I can't remember much about Turn. I can remember the school, but I don't remember much about it, other than the schoolmaster was Mr. Burton, and the headmistress was Mrs. Green. That may be something that they told me. I don't think I actually remember. But we went to St. Joseph's School in Ramsbottom because that, of course, we were Catholics, you see. And that was on Lodge Street.
So what day? When would you start going there? When you
went? As soon as we'd gone to Edenfield, I'd be about six then, one or six and a half, seven. Lodge Street is right behind St. Joseph's Church in the bottom. And it was an awful place. It really was. It was a two-story school. Just one room downstairs and one room upstairs. And we had a canteen which was in the cellar of the house. Belonging to the priests, you see. I mean, they were nice enough and the teachers were all right. But we had the smallest schoolyard you've ever seen in your life. But whilst I was there, they opened a new school on Queen Street. Now, I can't tell you what you have forgotten. Because it's on the school. And it was like going into heaven. It really was. It was wonderful. Great big playing areas, a lovely classroom, open classrooms. What a difference, yes.
How big were your classes?
Oh, quite big. I would say between 25 and 30. Yeah, probably more at Lodge Street because there was just nowhere to put them. You see, you just went in and sat on long forms, you know, and there was a desk, sort of a long desk in front of you, you know. But I don't think we did any harm education-wise. I mean, we had some good teachers. Very strict.
What were your lessons? Were they sort of... Can you remember anything about the lessons?
No, I can't remember. No. The only lessons I really remember, there used to be a technical school out Stubbins Lane, right opposite the fire station, where the double gates are, where that house is now. And that was a technical school. And we used to go there half a day a week to learn joinery. We went to joinery and the girls went upstairs to cookery. And it was a Miss Fenwick was the teacher upstairs, I remember her. And a Mr. Cam was the joiner master. And if he heard you talking, he threw a fish over at you. And invariably he hit you. Yeah, half a day a week we used to go there. So the rest of the lessons... I suppose it was general education, you know. We always had prayers and we always had a religious half hour, you know, one at some time of the day. And there was always grace before meals, even though we were only going into the place, you know. There was always a little bit, well, of course it was a church school, you see, wasn't it?
Any physical education, physical training?
Right? No, we played football, but we never got any real, no. We used to do... physical jerks and all this sort of thing, but nothing serious at all. We never had a decent football team because I never remember a man teacher at St. Joseph's in Ramsbottom. Not until I went to Queen Street, and then the headmaster was still a lady, you know, headmistress, I should say. But
did your sisters and brothers go there?
Yes, we all went there, yeah. We all went there, all of us. And we used to take other people from Edenfield. As the youngsters started, we used to take them down with us. You know.
You walked down?
Once we got to Edenfield, we used to go down the tram, you see. You know, the old trams, you see. Like you said there. But it wasn't as old as that. It wasn't quite like that. It was a different... that's an earlier model, obviously, isn't it? But we used to be able to run. We used to be able to run along and jump on the tram when it was going. Us youngsters.
So what did that cost you?
Oh, I don't know.
Penny or something?
A penny or something, yes. Very little.
And you caught it back up again?
Oh, yes, caught it back up again, yes. If we were lucky, if we caught it, if we didn't, we walked it, you see. I mean, we used to go to church from Turn, and we used to walk it on a Sunday morning, down what we call the cinder pad.
Mm.
You know, that is behind the Duckworth Arms, as the path goes right up the field to the... almost to the animal sanctuary.
There's one called Love Lane.
Well, it's Love Lane. We always call it the cinder pad. Yeah, Love Lane, that's right, Love Lane. Yeah, we always used to go up there, and then down Shea Fay, and either out Waterside or out Summit Lane, to church, and then walk back again. Yeah.
So, can you say a bit about the church? Did you go sort of twice a day? Or?
Oh, no, we only went to Mass, that was it. Yeah, we never had. They had Sunday school, but it was too far. I mean, by the time we got back home, it was dinner time, you know. And of course, my dad was a Catholic, and my mother wasn't. But she eventually converted to the Catholic faith.
Yes.
But they went for a little because they never had time. They couldn't, you know, she couldn't do it. But they died Catholics, and you know, yeah. I think there was quite a bit of a feud when my mother and dad got married because she was married a Catholic. But we had the shop down Rochdale Road, and I never found any bias at all. We were very involved with the Rochdale Road Methodists, obviously, you know, the shop, you see, right opposite. And we used to go to the concerts, and in fact, I learned to play snooker upstairs in they were all elderly people. Well, to me, they were all elderly gentlemen, you see. But I must have been there, and we used to go watch them bowl on the bowling green. That's lovely there.
That's behind the church.
Yeah, just behind the church, and there was a tennis court lower down. You see.
Did you play tennis there?
No, I didn't. No, I think that was a closed shop. You know, I don't think you could get in. I knew a lot of the people who played, of course. But an example was they actually asked my mother, and she did it for years, when they had the procession at Whitsuntide. They had a field day, which was in the field where all the bungalows are, next to the chapel. It was just a complete field in meadow in that day. And she used to have the stall, the sweets and the drinks and the ice cream and everything. You know, I mean, that was something that in a lot of places they'd have frowned on it, wouldn't they? Because we were, you know, we went and helped with the stall, and of course we joined in the races and the bit of fun, you know. And we were accepted extra. I think I've always thought that the Enfield people, because there was quite a number of Catholics in Enfield, and I don't think anyone were ever harassed or embarrassed by the other communities, you know. I mean, you do hear about these awful things, like particularly in Ireland, don't you? But I've thought many times about it, and I've been thinking about the past, and I thought, you know, them people were good, because they could have been just as different, couldn't they?
Did you have anything to do with the bosses at Bridge Mills?
Yeah, I knew them.
Did you ever sort of come and ask for favours or anything?
No, I don't think so. I'll tell you what did happen a lot, but this was dead in Clough Mill. You know the one in the bottom? That's just been pulled down recently. Well, there it was a cotton spinning place. And everything, the sprinklers and everything, was covered in cotton. And it was always setting on fire. And my father eventually managed to get part of that meadow for a poultry then. And he had a lot of hens in that field across the road. And when the sprinklers went off and building off, he would be one of the first to hear it. Because it went off in the evening, usually. And he'd call to us, and me and my brother and him, I'd go coming down the road just and knock the doors open and get the horse pipe out, and by the time the fire brigade come, we had a horse pipe going, you see. You know, we knew all the routing, and we could get in quite easily, and the flames would go up, and they'd run along the sprinkler as quick as that. Absolutely. And it was all burned away, see. There was never a very serious fire, but it cleaned it up in a way. Eh? But anyway, the fire brigade always came and sorted it all out. But the crux was that a few days later, when we went home, Mr. Schofield, Mr. Harry Schofield was the old gentleman, and then there was his son, and then his grandson. Then I bring up to the shop, and then I brought two envelopes. There was one for my dad and one for the boys. And there was a 10-shilling note in each envelope. There was 10-shilling for my father and 10-shilling between those two lads, because we'd helped on the fire. And they never missed doing that. First time it came, of course, we were, 10 shillings? Good luck!
What was the weekly wage, a pound in those?
Well, I should think it must have been, yeah. I wouldn't think it was. I started at 12 and 6 a week. And that wasn't bad, you see. And then it went to 15 shillings, then it went to 17 and 6. I think I was around about £1.25 when I was 21. But those days, you had to do 7 years to really learn the trade, you see.
Well, seems to have sort of got onto your trade. So let's continue with that now.
That's right. Well,
you left school at what age?
14.
14.
And I wanted to be a joiner, but there was no vacancy, so I ended up a painter. Now, I think my dad was quite happy because he got one as a painter, because I did an awful lot of work at all. But I was lucky. Wersick took to me like I was one of their own. They were really, really good to me. Mr. Wersick was a widower when I started there, the elderly gentleman, and his son, Aaron Wersick's father. You know Aaron Wersick, of course, don't you?
No.
I don't know Aaron Wersick. Do you not?
The only Wersick I know is Margaret Dunn.
Well, of course, she was his wife,
yeah.
Margaret.
You said they were good to you, or the worst?
They were very good. Mm. And I went there as an apprentice, and we had there was a shop, which was a double fronted shop at 57, and right across the road were all those little cottages are in square, you know, where they built those new houses. There was a row of cottages with a workshop in the middle, and that was our workshop downstairs. And the gentleman, an ex-joiner, retired joiner, had the upstairs part, Bob Salisbury. I don't know if you remember anything about him or not. He was a cabinet maker, and he was a wonderful workman. Wonderful. I used to watch him, because I spent, in the winter time, of course, there was never much work, and there was about three of us apprentices. One was younger, one was older than me, but we spent all our time in the workshop cleaning up and painting. I mean, in those days, it was hand-cart work. You know, you were lucky if you got took anywhere. You see, you had to push a hand-cart up to turn with about 500 acre mortar on. But it was good, and they were really good to me. And very often, if they wanted to go out, they'd come across for me, and I went in the shop. I looked after the shop.
What did they sell in the shop then?
Oh, wallpaper. But there was, during the war, when we got married, and I'm just going to tell you this part, we were going to get married, and we put our name down for one of those houses, those red brick houses down Rochdale Road. I don't know who would have paid for it, but anyway, because Wersick and Foster's built them. Am I going on too much?
No, that's fine.
Wersick and Foster's, it was a joint, they were very friendly, and they built them. Fussers built them, we plastered them, we painted them. And they were £450 and £475 if you put your own fireplaces. So we put our name down for this, and Fred Wersick came to me one day and he said, Harry, what are you going to... He'd met Nora, of course, and she came from Bolton. And he said, what's Nora going to do when you get married? Because obviously she'd have to leave her job in Bolton. And I said, oh, well, she'll find a job. And he said, how would you like the shop? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm going to build a house just down the road, he said, because his wife had had a number of miscarriages. I don't know how many. Goodness gracious. He said, and the doctor said, if she can rest for the whole 9 months, she would carry, you see. He said, you can be the supervisor when you're 21, and she can you can come and live in the shop rent-free. She'll run the shop, and you can be the foreman eventually. Because, of course, the war had broke out, and everybody was going, you see. But I was grade four. That was something else. I went to Bolton, hoping to join the RAF, and this, as soon as he saw this, he said, there's no way. You know, I've still got my grade four car in there, in this somewhere. So I, of course, asked Nora what she thought, and she said, yeah, because it was a lovely house. So we stayed there for, 5 or 6 years, you know. All through the war we were there, but we had little stuff to sell. So we only opened part days, you know. But, and then, of course, when the war broke out, anybody that didn't go to the war had to go on war work. Well, I don't know how he did this. Fred Worsett got the contract for ICI at Townsend Fold for the Perspex factory. And he got the contract of painting and decorating there. So I went there as a supervisor, and I was there all through the war. I never came away. And so that saved me going away from home.
Were you painting at the ICI plant?
Yes, painting and cleaning and all sorts of things. And I had about a dozen men, because it had to be absolutely spotless. You can understand that. If they poured it, and there was the slightest bit of dust or a fleck or anything, scrap, you see. And we did as much cleaning as we did painting, you know. We'd wash the ceilings down and wash the walls down, and then we'd paint them more, and you know. We'd clear out of one room, clear it all out, you know, and then we did all the floors. And that went on until the end of the war, yeah. So I was lucky in so far as I stayed at home, you see. And then, of course, the children came along, and the shop got... We eventually moved out of the shop. Fred's sister-in-law took over the shop for a short time. And Mrs. Worsick had the boy, Harold, and she was successful. I think she rested and was in hospital most of the time. And they just had the one child. And we were like aunt and uncle to them, because we nursed him, we wheeled him out, and, you know. And I'm still very, very friendly with him. Yeah, very friendly with him.
So did you actually serve a full apprenticeship?
Oh, yes, 7 years. Yeah.
So you left school at...
14.
So by the time you were 21...
I'd done 7 years, yeah.
But had you taken charge of the shop by that stage?
No, it was just after I was 21. I was nearly 22 by the time I took charge of the shop. Yeah. I mean, nobody. There was only one or two of our own lads at home, well, men, and they didn't want the job. But they came to us to Townsend Fold with me, you know. They were a lot older than me, but we were quite happy. But the rest were people from Rottenstall and Bolton, and they even sent some from Liverpool from the Dole, you know, because if you needed a extra one or two, you just got through to the Dole at Rottenstall, and they sent these people in. And they found them accommodation in Rottenstall, and they painted it, you know. That was very interesting. And the Perspex plant, there was all sorts of things made, of course, as you will understand, Jewish, you know. And one of them was the most unusual, because there was a man there called Roland Whittaker, and he was the arts and crafts master at Rossendale Grammar School. And he'd gone there because it would be war work, you see. And he made a violin out of Perspex. I was learning the violin, and I learned for quite a few years. Not that it was any good, but... And I said to Roland, I got very friendly with him, actually, and I said, look, this won't play. I said, there's no way this is going to play. I said, because the tone comes from the wood of a violin. He said, well, never mind. And it was absolutely gorgeous. The bow was Perspex. All the case was Perspex. You could see through it, you know, inside it and everything. And I provided him with the strings. I don't think I provided the goat. But anyway, it was done. And I got the job of playing it. And honestly, I was dumbfounded. It played beautifully.
What happened to it?
It went to London. But after that, I never heard of it.
I have seen a photograph of a...
Have you?
Perspex violin.
Yes. Well, I don't know what happened, and I don't know whether Roland's dead or alive. I haven't seen him, for goodness knows how many years. I don't know anything about him. But I was firmly convinced that this thing would never play. Because I was always told that the better the violin and the better the tour. Came out beautifully. Honestly, I was flabbergasted. I played this thing up, turned in full, up the works, you know. It was done with the knowledge of the management, because, of course, it was shown to the bosses and all the rest of it, and it went to an exhibition in London. So I don't know what happened to it, but it was amazing, really, wasn't it?
How did you come to meet your wife, Nora?
Well, that's another funny story, really, but... I used to play football, even though I had a very bad leg, and I played for St. Joseph's at Ramsbottom. And we always had we had a Catholic rambling club. And we were both in the rambling club. And we used to play Bolton Catholic Ramblers every year at their place and every year at our place, you see. And we always had a social evening after.
Ramsbottom
St. Joseph's, and it was St. Joseph's Rambling Club. And we always had a meal. We always provided a meal, and then we had a dance in the evening, you see. So on this occasion, it was at Bolton. So my sister Mary said, well, I'll come with you. I said, well, there's plenty of partners, and you'll be all right, you'll enjoy it, you know. So we went to Ramsbottom, but I think one of these things let us down. Because by the time we got to Ramsbottom, the coach had gone. So we went to the top of the Baptist River Cairbar, and eventually got a river bus into Bolton. I had a bit of an idea where the club was, as we'd seen the place before. So we eventually found this club, but by the time we got there, there was no way I was going to a football match. Because the match would be on, and they said, oh, it's 2 miles away or whatever, you know, they couldn't get fields. But all these young women and one or two lads were getting the tea ready, you see. So, of course, we had to help. Well, we didn't have to help, but we did. And that's how I met my wife.
Making sandwiches.
making sandwiches. I took her out on the following Saturday, and we courted her for about 3 years, and then we got married. And we were married for 54 years.
There you go.
She was a cracker. She was a lovely girl.
Was she doing in Bolton? She was working there.
She did. She was in the finishing department of a garment place. And she did a lot of what they call like ladders and silk stockings.
Yes.
Or she could pick them up with a little machine needle that she had, a special tool, and she could pick them up and repair them. And during the war, she repaired hundreds of.
Is that Birmingham Mending or something like that?
No, that wasn't the name. It was a place right on the corner. If you go from Bury to Bolton, you've got the main road right into Bolton, and it's right on the corner before you come onto Bradshaw Gate.
And this was materials she was making?
She was mending. They made all these things. They did silk stockings. They made all sorts of things. Vests, underwear. And if there'd been a stick dropped, she used to pick them up.
Oh. Yeah. So she got good eyesight.
Yes. Actually, when she did the silk stockings, I got some Perspex magnifying glasses made. I had some Perspex, big, thick ones, and they concurred it, you know, and it was wonderful. And I had a brass stand made, and she put her hand underneath, you see, and she could see in the stitches. I don't know where that went. Yeah.
So, where were you married?
St. Edmund's Church in Bolton. And, of course, the war was on, but everything went very well. There was only one time my brother had a brother, and he went in the militia, which, of course, started before the war, you remember?
Oh, the Accrington Pals, that sort of thing.
Well, that sort of thing. But anybody 18-year-old had to go in the army for 12 months. And, of course, Jim was unlucky. He went in for 12 months and stayed in for 5 years, you see. And he was abroad, so he couldn't be my best man. But Nora's brother, he was in the Air Force. He was in the flying crew. And he was a test pilot, actually. And he was our best man.
How did he go on for receptions during the wartime?
Yeah, well, we had one, but it wasn't very big. We had no money, you know. We just had cups of tea and cakes and a bit of something to eat, sandwiches or something.
The war hadn't started when you married. It was just
You see, we didn't get married until the 30th of September, and the war broke out in the early days of September, didn't it? The war, but we'd already booked everything, you know, before, you see. I often said the war broke out, we weren't to blame for the war.
And you came and lived at Market
Street. And then we came down here, and the children arrived, and, you know. We came into the Central Avenue for the hairdressers because the lady who was giving up. And we had a wonderful insurance manager in Real called Andy Ashworth. I probably don't know him. But he had 5 or 6 children, and they lived up Hawthorne Avenue there. And he was a wonderful man. He knew everybody in the village. He went around collecting for the credentials. You know the type of person I mean.
Yeah.
And he was a friend to everybody. You're right. He was a wonderful man. And he came to our house one day and he said, "Do you know, Nora?" He used to come. He'd always have a cup of tea when he came around there. And he said, since I was at work, he said, "There's something over there that would just suit you." He said, "I'm sure you would." He said, "Mrs. Stevens is selling up her hairdressing business." He said, "And they're going to live in the way somewhere." So I said, he said, "Why don't you have a go at it?" You know. So when I came home from work, of course, he told me all this story, you see. I said, "Well, come on, let's go and see." He says, "You may be disbanding the place, we don't know." So I'll go across and have a look. So I went and had a look, and it was the village council houses have a very long through room with a small sitting room on the side, on the other half of the house. And this was the hairdressing portion. It wasn't in the part where you lived. So it was very well set up. So I said, "Well, there's only one thing that stops us, and that's whether the council will still allow us to carry on, because they did allow little businesses in them days." Anyhow, I saw Harry Hilton, he was the house manager in those days, and he said, "Oh, there's no reason why you shouldn't buy it." He said, "If you want it, you have it, and we'll give you permission to carry on." So we had it for quite a number of years, and it was very good.
How did she learn hairdressing?
She had learned hairdressing at Bolton before she went into this other job. I think the pay was very small, you know, but she came in hairdresser as a girl, you see, and of course never lost it. She always did her own, and the new sisters and all this, you know, my mother and my auntie John, and goodness knows what. So she soon picked it up again, and she went to Manchester somewhere. One of the firms that they got the material off offered her a training course. So she went down there for a short time, about a month, I think, sort of, I suppose, knowing the new techniques. And it was very successful. I think it was only 4 and 6% for a washing set, you know, if I remember rightly.
And they came to her?
Yeah, they came to her, and they sat in the room. And they always got a cup of tea and a homemade bun. And we lived there until, you see that little thing?
Have you got children by this?
Oh, yes, yeah, we had all three boys then. And, of course, they were getting quite grown up, you see. Kevin, that little photograph over there, that's our youngest son. And he started being ill there, and he died with cancer. And he was only 17. So that was an absolute tragedy, as you can well imagine, you see. He started being ill, and he was dead in a few weeks. He'd been a wonderful... He was at Thornley College and had done very, very well. And he'd started at Forest and Spencer's as a training manager. And he'd only been there 6 weeks when he started being ill. And he died. Which was absolutely horrendous. But as time went on, I could see that my life was going down and down and down. His bedroom, he had a bedroom of his own, and the lads had a bigger bedroom, the other two younger ones. And the bedroom was like a shrine. And she was spending an awful lot of time in that bedroom. So I thought, "Oh, this is no good, we're going to have to get out, you know." So I got on to the company, Cup of Porridge, well, Porridge and Spencer's in those days, and I got at the house at Stubbins Hill Terrace. And I went home and told them, and I got in such an awful row, because they didn't want to leave the house, you see. But I insisted, and they liked it eventually, but I think she would have died if she'd have stayed there, because it was an awful, yes it was. We were both for a long time, and then all of a sudden we realised that we had two more children, and we had to pull ourselves together for the benefit of them, you see, which we did. I mean, it'll be 40 years this year since he died, you see, so he would have been 57, isn't he? Why these things should happen to somebody, I don't know, because he was an absolute wonder. Played cricket for Edenfield, played football for St. Joseph's. He's a brilliant, I think he would have made a very good cricketer in the days of Mr. Jim Fisher. You may have heard of him at Edenfield, from the baker shop.
Oh, yeah.
That was sickness. Well, Jim Fisher thought a lot of him. And a chap that lives down here, what's he called? I can't remember his name.
Simpson. George Simpson.
No, not George Simpson. He's a lot to do with the cricket club.
Oh. Hammerson, but he's in Marketplace.
He lives down in the, on the Eden Avenue. Oh, I can't come in now. I can see where I can't come in now. It doesn't matter. We went to Stubbins.
So you left the... Nora gave up the hairdressing.
We gave up the hairdressing. We sold the equipment and it went back to her house. Mm-hmm. We didn't try to sell it.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get out, you know. We got a nice... It was a very nice house at Stubbins. It was a big, one of those big tourist ones on the top as you're going... As you're going up Stubbins Street, have you been up there? There's four houses, five houses on the top with the... In the houses then when Kevin died. And it was a very nice house, and we stayed there until my wife died. Which was 30-odd years, you see. But I'd gone to Porritts in the meantime. I'd left Worsick. Worsick was... Fred was... In fact, Fred died. But we'd just left us before. We used to do all Porritts works, all the farms, and the property and everything, for Porritts and Spencer's. In fact, we did Colonel Porritts' house, you know, the cliff. I spent an awful lot of time with at Porritts. So, of course, I knew the bosses and the directors and, you know. And we applied during the war to see if they were we going to have it. And they said, yes, we are. But there's no point. We can't take you on, because if we take you on, they'll just take you away and send you on over. But immediately the war's over, we will contact you again. And two of us went from Worsick there. And I took over as foreman. He was off all of me. He said, oh, no, he didn't want it. So I took over as supervisor there. And eventually, I got bigger. We got staff. There was only two to start with. But I picked my own, the men that I knew were tradesmen, you know. And we had some good tradesmen at Stubbins. And then eventually, the group, I took over supervising for the group. And I had about eight factors to look after. Yeah, Rossfield, Stubbins, Bamford, Broadway, two at Elmshore. Yeah. There were about eight factories. I used to go out, so I didn't do any decorating for a long, long time, until I retired and then I started doing it for the family and all the rest of it. But I hadn't time, you see. I mean,
did you work till you were 65?
I worked till I was 64. And I started having ill health. I used to have a nice van, and I used to run the fellows around. And when, of course, in those days, we had a fortnight's holiday, wage weeks, didn't we? Which they don't seem to have these days. And of course, the factory wanted all the place decorated in 2 weeks, you know. What a nightmare. They never got it, but they always wanted it. And I used to ship them in from Bamford and Northfield or wherever, bring them all in and do that mill, because they were different times. We'd be up and down shore for the whole fortnight, you see, and do as much as ever we could. They could work overtime all night if they wanted, provided we got the work done. And then the week after we'd be at Vary, you see, or wherever the holidays were. And that was a bit of a trouble, because Stubbins, Ramsbottom and Vary were always same holidays, you know. And Broadway Mill was started, that started up. Soon after I'd taken over, so I've known that Broadway mill since it was built, you know. So I had that for quite a long time, yeah.
So can you say something, how you've seen decorating change in your lifetime? Because there must have been some big changes.
Unfortunately, it hasn't changed for the better. I mean, the trade, they look at them today, you know, job to find it. That's a part of my... working life, people used to ask me who to get to do their decorating for them. Because I'd done a lot in the past for people, and so had everybody else. But you couldn't, I wouldn't know who to recommend. Because even though I was in charge, I used to get let in by firms. They'd promise you the moon, and I was subletting work, because I had so much work that you couldn't possibly do it. And I'd have a firm from Bolton, two or three different companies in. And they spent more time coming back doing touching up after they'd gone away than they did during the holidays. It was wicked. They had one or two good painters and the rest were just nothing.
I mean, what about sort of paint brushes?
That's right. There's a better... I mean, the range of... In my day, we made all
when
our...
When you started?
We made all our own paint from white lead and stainers and dryers. All that was the sort of thing we did in the paint shop, you see. We had three great barrels linseed oil, boiled linseed oil, genuine turps, and sub-turps. Sub-turps is like paraffin, isn't it?
Substitute, that's right.
And we used to get kegs of lead, and they were about so far round, but they were that big, and that was 100 weight, you see. In fact, I've still got a little bit of white lead.
You bought that as a paint, did you?
Yeah, well, they bought that as a paste. In a barrel, just the white lead. And you broke it up, you know, broke it all up, and then you put stainers in to make whatever colour you wish, you see. And then the dryers in those days was a paste, and nowadays it's a liquid. But in those days it was a paste, and you had to put dryers in enough to make it dry.
I mean, was that a sort of a pint of dryers, or...?
Well, you just guess, you know, we got to the same weed, and you knew what to put in. If you wanted it to dry quick, you put a bit extra in, you see, and then you got two coats on in one day.
What about the linseed oils?
Well, the linseed oil, you see, linseed oil doesn't dry, but boiled linseed oil does. And a little funny story. We were working during the holiday period at Stubbins, and we were doing the canteen, which was quite a big room in the kitchen, you see. And we left our... Oh, it's absolutely pouring now. And we'd left our paintbrushes and cans in there while we went to have a brew. We had quite a nice paint shop. And when we went to that hour, we got our lunch, that's right. And when we went back, we could see that somebody tipped some paint out of one of the gallon tins, you see. And they made a right mess on one of the benches in the kitchen. So there was only about 3 or 4 people around the place, you see. Everybody had gone, but there were only painters and joiners, and we knew the joiners wouldn't do it, they didn't want to do it, they'd have asked, you know. And we rather suspected it was the watchman, you know, so where would he put it? So we searched around, and we found it where he'd hidden this. It was one of those large jam tins, you know, with a lid on it, you see, and we found it at the back of some machinery. So I said, oh, I'll cure this fellow, you see. So I got some raw linseed oil and I poured it in, you see, and I said, there you go, put the lid back on, and that was it, you see. A few weeks later, he was crowing his head off and saying, ruddy paint of these lot used to dry. So, of course, we all, you know, we all started, Stanley Hall, he was called. A ruddy paint, he said, it never dries. He took it home and done the woodwork. Back a bit.
So what did you actually use the raw linseed oil for then?
Well, very often we put it in as a base, but we used both. We used to dilute the boil sometimes. And linseed oil we used, of course, a lot. We made our own putty. You know, we made our own putty.
A mastic.
We used it for mastic pointing. When we were doing outside of a door, we'd be mastic pointing. And then we always used to make our own putty. You know.
And what was that made from?
It was like gravel, it was like sand that we used to get, but it was very, very fine, so I don't really know what it was. And we used to put it through and then mash it, you know. It was very good, yeah. The drums were, we used to get, people used to bring cricket bats to Fred Worsick, and we used to put them in the tank, in the oil tank, and hold them and prop them so that they were in just below the handle. In the raw linseed oil.
Raw linseed oil, yeah.
And leave that in there. We used to leave the bat in for perhaps a week or a fortnight, you know.
And that's how I'd lick off.
Oh, that was lovely. It made it really supple, you know, good. And then take them out and let it drain and then go for them, you know. Yeah. I've done that many times.
So when did they stop sort of making their own? Was that sort of after the war?
Yes, yeah. It started everybody, you know, yeah. Yeah. What they call the porrit colour. It was like a peachy red, in a way, and that was what it was always known as porrit colour, and we always made that up. And we put enough boil oil in for it to look like gloss paint. And it shone like gloss paint, and it wore extremely well, you know. I mean, there was gloss paints, but they were more enamels in my day, and they were so hard, and they were so expensive. the contract jobs, you couldn't afford to do it yourself. I mean, it was on top of one mill, there'd be 20 ventilators. You know, these great big metal ones that with a top on. Well, if you'd done them within a month, it was out of all reason. And so, of course, we used to make our own gloss paint. That's what it was. It was glossy paint, you see. That's what it was. It wasn't...
What about varnish?
Well, varnish, of course, there was always loads of varnish about. And it was good varnish. Today, I don't know, there never seems to be any body in it, you know.
And did you sometimes just put an ordinary coat on and then varnish it?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, glaring was in favour in those days, wasn't it? I mean, we had to be able to grain. I never considered myself an expert, but I could grain. You know, I could do enough.
Mm.
And sign writing as well. But I never got time after once I started supervising. But we always had somebody in the team that was a damn good sign writer. Some people could do it no bother, you know. And I had a very good grainer. Came from Athens. He was brilliant. And of course, he always varnished then, you see. You know. Many times you could do an ordinary undercoat and varnish if you wish. But the only trouble with varnish then, you could get clear, but it always had a little bit of an orangey tinge, you know. And especially if you didn't brush it out quite right, and, you know, you might have just left a little bit of extra varnish on somewhere, and it showed the difference, you know. Whereas sometimes we mix varnish in with the paint. We've done that before today.
To make it
glossy.
Glossy,
you know?
and harder.
You see, the only trouble about putting varnish in was that it didn't cover as well. But if you put paint with paint and boil out, it seemed to cover very well, you know.
What about rollers? Did you use rollers from the start?
No, never. No, it was always brush. Yeah, I ended up with spray guns, and we had some very, very expensive equipment, you know. We got all the high-pressure sprays and all that sort of thing the last few years, and, yeah, I mean, you could go through a lot of day in an hour and a half. You could do a bit in a weaving shed in an hour and a half, whereas it took you ages, because you didn't need to move the planks very far, you see. There was always struts across, you know, and we put planks on. Oh, you only need a couple of planks because you could spray it all, you see.
That was easier than rollers, though.
Much quicker. It was dirtier, you know, and you got sprayed.
Yeah.
And we had to make a lot of gear on the ground, you know.
Yeah.
You had to cover everything up because it sprayed all over. But it brushed off, you see.
What about wallpapers?
Wallpapers, sixpence a roll, fivepence a roll, you know, and was that? Oh, there's some lovely papers.
Did you trim your own?
Yes. Oh, yeah. You used to sit with them on your feet like that. I used to strip it like that. And then we moved on to that, and we did it on the thunder, on a pasting board.
Yeah.
And that was a much bigger one. It was about size of one and a half size of my hand. And it had an adjustable lever on, you know, and you could... But it was all hand-trimmed, yeah. And if you slipped up with it, you were in a bit of a mess when you come to put it on, you know. And, of course, then they started with the... there was no trimming on them, you see. They were all trimmed. And for a while, that was bad. Because they didn't trim them very well as either, you know.
What about adhesives for wallpaper?
Well, that was flour. We never used, you know, until I went to Porridge, I don't think we ever used paste. We always used plain flour and a bit of carbonated soda. And that made wonderful paste. Yeah.
So what was the recipe for that?
Well, you just made the flour look like...
Was it sort of a gallon of water and a...
Oh, you just
pound of flour or what?
You just made your flour thick. And then you poured it in until it scalded, and you could and it come up, and that was enough water. And you stopped. There were no sort of measuring.
It was boiled.
Yeah, boiled. Oh, yes, it was boiled. Oh, yeah, it was boiled. Oh, yeah, you boiled the water had to be absolutely boiling. And the quicker you poured it on, and the more pace you got. If you poured it on slow, it would make up in quick time. You'd only have half a bucket. Whereas if you poured, sometimes you'd have two big pans, you see. And one of it out of here and one there. And then we'd both pour it in together and whip it up quick and you'd have a bucket full of paste. Yeah. It was a long time before packet paste ever came, you know. We used to have the dextry. That was like a very, very strong adhesive. That was brown. That was always in packets. And that was wonderful stuff for cornish work or repairing your plastic cornices. You know, you could do a lot with dextry. Yeah. I don't know whether that's still going. I wouldn't know, whatever, because I don't keep in touch. You know. Yeah, yeah.
Let's just have a quick look through the crib sheet to see what... where did your children go to school? You mentioned that Julia's school, they went in that.
They went to St. Joseph's on Queen Street, and then the eldest boy and my youngest boy went to Thornleigh College at Bolton. It was a boys' college in those days, and I'm still involved.
Oh.
Still involved there.
That's a Catholic college.
Yes. Off Sherpas Park. I'm still involved. I was there last Wednesday.
And then?
And then the younger boy, the middle boy, that's the one at the top there, with his cap and gown on, he couldn't pass an exam to save his life when he was a boy. He took every exam that was going. The other two are passed, no bother, you know. But he couldn't pass anything. He was always the type that his hands, whatever he used his hands, moulding, anything, fishing, whatever, he could do it. But he couldn't pass an exam. And he used to say to me, "What's the matter with me, Dad? I can't pass." And he used to get quite upset, you know. And I used to say, "Look, don't worry about it. You know that everyone's not alike." When he left school, he wanted to be a chef. And he was 15, of course, by that time. And his mum took him to Manchester, she took him to Bolton, she took him to Oldham. And he got in at Bolton Technical College as a student. And he became a chef. And he did very, very well indeed. He was the only student he ever sent to Germany and Switzerland from the college. And he was the first chef at the old mill in Ramsbottom. He was working at the Scarrow's Brick in Southport after he finished his training. And he was a chef at Scarrow's Brick. And he used to come home in the middle of the week, you see, for a couple of days, you know. And he had an hospital sports care. And he came home this year, and I'd heard from councillor friends of mine, that there was going to be this restaurant in Ramsbottom. In fact, we had a bowling match at the pub, which is just behind it. And Tom Ash was the councillor, and he said to me, "Come here, I want to show you something." We looked over the top, and he said, "You see there?" I said, "No, that's the old poultry place." It was a candle and wax factory originally, and then it was a deep litter poultry farm. Poultry, you know. And he said, "They're going to have a restaurant there." I said, "Tommy, what's it?" "Yeah, he's sure." He said, "The planning permission in for it." I said, "Good God, they'll never make it. You know, it's a filthy place." And then, lo and behold, when Trevor came home, I said to him, "Look, there's going to be a restaurant." I said, "I'm not coming to work in Ramsbottom." Like these kids are. And I said, "Oh, all right." So off he went, and he went back to Scarisbrick, and he was there for quite some time. Came home one day and he said, "I've been for an interview this morning." I said, "Oh, yeah, where are you going?" He said, "I've got the chef's job at the old mill." And it wasn't finished then, it wasn't completed. So he went in and he helped to design the kitchens and goodness knows what. And he's never looked back. Eventually, he stayed there, 5 years, 6 years probably. And then he went back to Bolton as a lecturer. Got some exams and went back into sitting guilds and, you know. Went back to Bolton as a lecturer, then came to Bury as a lecturer, and then he went on to Blackburn as a lecturer. And he ended up dean of faculties. And he took early retirement last year, and he's now gone back as a lecturer 3 days a week. And he's 54 years old.
Very good.
So that's people have said to Nora and I many, many times, "I heard so-and-so can't pass 11 plus. So just have a look at our chair." I said, he's an example. I said, he's done so well. I said, it's unbelievable, you know. And he ended up being a faculty up there, so he had a good rolling on shaping.
The other one was Kevin, was it?
Kevin was the one that died.
Yeah, and then there was...
And my youngest son, he was in the police force up here at Lancashire. And he did his training, and then he went to Hutton. This is a funny story, really. And he'd been going out with a young lady who was a friend of our... Some friend, he was a daughter of our friends. And that's still going. I feel what this is going to be like. And we'd taken her with us to this open day when he was passing out. You see. Lo and behold, he picked up with another girl when we got there. It was so embarrassing. And she was from Poole in Dorset. And her mother and father was there. Anyway, we all got together and had a natter and all the rest of it. We went out with him, had a meal out and all this. But anyway, he left the girl up here and he married the girl from down Poole. And they've been wonderfully happy, and they have three children. And they moved, when they got married, he said to her, of course it's 30 years since, you say. He said, look, he didn't like women being in the police force. He said, it's no job for a woman because of the sex things, you know. He said, if you'll come out of the police force, we'll go down south and live down south. And she did. And they went to living in, they lived in Hampshire. They lived all over the place, you know. He transferred to the Hampshire police. So I think I've decorated as many houses in Hampshire as anybody else. Because he went from Aldershot to Hythe and to all over the place, you know. But of course he did very well. He was in the special branch. His wife, is a president of the Lifesavers Association for Great Britain. And last year she was presented with a special trophy in London. And you know, if you've seen 999 on the television,
yes.
Well, at the end of 999 program, they always appeal for people who want to learn resuscitation. And she runs that program for the BBC.
Oh.
Yeah, and she says they take, in fact, Graham used to go a lot, and the daughter that's got, granddaughter that's hoping to be a doctor, she goes along, because she's passed her all of his sons. They take 500 on a Saturday and 500 on a Sunday. And she says within an hour, it's booked up. Well, they have them all over the place. And she was very disappointed recently, she had one in Birmingham, hoping that the ethnic people would join in. And there were 6 out of all the 1,000 people turned up. She said, we did it deliberately to see if they wanted to take part. I said, and if you'd have said it was for white people only, there'd have been such an outcry, wouldn't it? She said, I was so disappointed, Don. She said, I really thought they would have taken advantage of it, you know.
But,
Sorry.
Let's have a look at something else. Oh. Can you sort of remember any change sort of in medicine, in GPs and whatnot?
Today the amount of drugs that you can get, I mean, once a day, the doctors made all their own medicines up, didn't they? They shake a bottle up.
Where did you go?
We went to Dr. Laurie at Ramsbottom when we were children. That was at the top of Cave Row, right? As you come up Cave Row, there was a house right across the road. And he had a surgery in the back. He had a portable building in the back. And then when we came to it, when we got married, I came up here to Dr. Ford and Mrs. Ford. They were very nice people. I don't know very much about them. Yeah, very nice. He was a great man. He was a big Church of England and she was a Catholic. But they were extremely nice people. And they lived in that red brick house opposite the co-op. Next to where she lived, the one next door. That was originally one of Turnbull's houses. Not Edward Turnbull. One of the Turnbull brothers lived there, and he was never married. Can't think of his first name. And there was a Turnbull lived next door to Stubbing School. There was a Turnbull lived in the field. That was Billy. He was the councillor. And there was a Turnbull lived up there. All brothers.
Where would you go to hospital? Did you ever go to...
Ramsbottom. I was in the cottage hospital with this knee when I was 16 years of age. And there was just six beds in the old
Sorry, work. How old were you?
16.
16, huh?
Mm, and I've had trouble with it ever since. Yeah. Well, it's not bad now, but I had an awful lot of trouble when I was younger.
I mean, how did you find it?
Oh, it was good. But it was Matron Lees and Sister Smith, and then I think there was one nurse besides that, about all. You know? That's one of each shift, I don't know. But there was very, very few. But she was a clerk, but she was good. I mean, she was fair enough, but oh my goodness, if you were out of line. And she used to come in.
That was for patients, it wasn't just the staff.
Oh, yeah, with the patients, yeah. Oh, you know. She was about 6 foot, and she was about 12 or 13 stone. She was a very good prison warder. In fact, goodness gracious. In fact, my boss, Mr. Alfie Worsing, was courting a bit with her. I think he was trying to. Because when I was in hospital, he used to come and see me and bring me bunches of grapes and all sorts, you know. And I thought, this is smashing, you know. And I think he was, well, he was falling on with the matron, like, you know. But he was, this is the sort of thing they were very good, you know. They were good people.
So was that your only visit to sort of the cottage hospital?
Yeah, I was in, and then I went in Wrightington.
Oh.
That's 30 years since, and it had to be stiffened.
Yeah.
It did bend a little bit, but it went one day when I was at work and they had to carry me home.
Was that Charnley at Grant?
Yes, Charnley. Yeah. And my old doctor came and he brought a specialist in from Bury Cove. He's retired now. And he said, well, there's only two things for you. It's either off to Radington and have it stiffened or have it taken off.
Oh, well,
so, there was no, you know, it was a case of stiffening it. So I went to Radington and I was there about 6 weeks.
Mm.
Yeah. They put a little, you know, like a joiner's cramp.
Yeah.
Through there. Yeah. And then each day they came and just
tightened
it up a little bit, you see. Yeah. And sandbagged it down to the bed, you know.
Yeah.
Mm. But it's just a nuisance, that's all now, you know. Yeah. Occasionally it gives me, I get trouble here.
Yeah.
Because it's weight bearing, I suppose, isn't it, you know.
Yeah.
But Rajanty was a wonderful place, I don't know.
So presumably later on it became Bury or
Robinson. Yeah. The cottage hospital is still going, but it's a sort of geriatric place, I think, now.
Mm. Are there any more Hoyles around in the neighbourhood?
Yes, there's quite a lot. Most of them, unfortunately, two or three of them died recently. But of course, I have five brothers and sisters all living. Four of us are over 8. Four of us out of the six are over 80. One of them's 87, one's 85, one's 83, I'm 81, well, that's four of us, and one's 80, well, that's five. Out of the six are over 80, and they're all living.
So you're a long-lived family, then.
Just about. I mean,
And are they living locally, or...?
No, well, Nelson, one lives, brother lives in Stubbins, he's 80.
Mm.
And two sisters live, Nelson and Cole, and they're 80. And I have a sister lives at Middleton, and she's 87.
Hmm.
So, you know. But unfortunately, one of my sisters at Nelson's just come out of Christie's.
Oh.
My brother was in Christie's at Christmas. So that we're cracking up.
Did you have any particular friends when you were at land?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we always had... this is what I was saying about having the piano. We always had a house full of, you know. It was a regular thing on a Saturday night and Sunday night. The lads, they all came round and they all came in. And
who played the piano?
All the sisters played the piano. All four of them. Yeah. They all four learned the piano.
From a local teacher?
Yeah, Olive Hill, she was called. She used to live, she died not, about 2 years ago on here. Mrs. Jim... Oh dear, my memory. Yes, he lived up Tieran. Those houses, as you're going up the turn, there's a long row just past where all the old ironwork used to be, just past the crusher. Olive Ilse was called, and she taught them. Yeah.
They could sing as well, presumably.
My dad wasn't a bad singer at all. We always used to have sing songs, you know.
Were there in any choirs?
My sisters and I were in St. Joseph's Choir at church, you know. Yeah. I used to blow the organ when I was a kid in short pants. And there was a piece of string hanging down with a weight on, you see. And you'd be working away and it'd have come down.
He had to get it back up again. It was measuring the reservoir, was it?
That's right.
But what, you mentioned that you played the violin a bit. But how did that come about?
Well, it was just a case of I would have liked to have played the piano.
Mm.
But there were that many of them playing the piano, I couldn't get near it, you see. So my dad bought a violin somewhere.
Mm.
And brought this home machine and said, "Go, oh, why don't you ever go?" So I went to Rottenstall to a chap called Grimshaw. But he was a fraud, really. He didn't do very well. And he always cut the lessons short. And I gave up in the end. I said to my mother, "You're wasting your money." Because I don't think I would have made one anyway. Not really.
You never got into an orchestra?
Oh, anything, no. I was never good enough for that. I never got very far, really.
No.
But it was a shame. But I think they wanted a musician in the family, you know. my youngest sister was the best pianist because she took lectures to pupils for quite some time. Yeah. Until she went to live in Nelson. She took pupils and got them through, you know.
What about clubs and organisations?
I've been involved in clubs and organisations all my life. I've been involved with St. Joseph's Church since I was a teenager. I was in the St. Vincent de Paul. I've done everything at the church. I led the processions. I've run the bingo for... My wife and I ran bingo for 16 years. Would you believe it?
Yeah.
But we weren't the only two. There were quite a few of us, you see. And I've been in Age Concern, Ramsbottom, which in the early days was the old people's welfare. When I started, and I've been in that for 30 years. We disbanded just before Christmas. Jenny Whittaker. Jenny Willis Whittaker? Hillis's?
Yes, sister.
Yes, well, she's been our president for a long time. Mrs. Greengrove, the grocer down Bridge, the butcher down Bridge Street. Mrs. Walmsley. Do you know her?
No.
You may have met her. She was our chairman when we packed up. I've been in that for 30 years. I was in the Knights of St. Columba there.
What about the Enfield Cricket Club?
Yes, I was a member of Enfield Cricket Club. I played for Enfield Cricket Club when I was about 16 or 17. Yeah, and I ran Enfield Football Club for about 6 or 7 years, when the children were about 5 and 6 and 7 years old.
So that'd be in the 1930s, 1940s.
I don't know. No,
it could have been. Yeah. Must have been after that. You're married in sort of 39.
Yeah.
And the children came along. 49.
Yeah. I can't remember what day she was. No. There's a lad called Brian Stone. His in-laws lived on Rochester Road, and he and I ran the team. I was the chairman, and he was. He was the goalkeeper actually, and we ran it for years. And there was an area shelter on the wreck in those days. The old aero shelter was there from the war. A brick building with a concrete top, you know. And it was derelict. So we went in and we put a door on and we decorated, we emulsioned it all, or whitewashed it, whatever. And I got some conduit from Bordets and we put all racks in for tying their clothes on. And I used to go and get a great big bag of sawdust from Wilson's joiners, because there was a joiner shop at this end and a joiner shop at the other end in those days.
Where was it at this end? I know where it was at the other
just
end.
Just now, you know where the hairdressers is?
Yes.
Right behind there.
Ooh.
That was Wilson's, and the one at the other end of the field was Pilling's. And Tom Wilson married Pilling's daughter. So, of course...
But the rope works there now.
Sorry?
There's the rope works behind the dress. The hairdressers in...
Rope works is up Rochester Road. I mean the hairdressers down Bury Road.
Ah, sorry.
The hairdresser down here.
Ah, okay.
Not the hairdressers at the market.
No, sorry.
That's the rope works, yeah.
It's
still going, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
That's been there. However, that roof stands up, I don't know, it's been like that.
Oh, you've repaired it recently.
It's been like that ever since I was a boy. Yeah.
Did you ever know anybody go to Edenfield Working Men's Club?
Yes.
I want to find somebody that knows something about Jeff Cheever knows something about it, of course.
I don't know much. I love Lady because I didn't go drinking, but I know I knew people drinking. Jack, a man called Jack Cheever lived up there, Jack of Jewels. He was a right character in the Eden Field.
Yeah.
They always used to say he could drink 12 pints of beer while the clock struck 12. He was well known. He was one of the men on the gas, at the gasworks.
Ah.
One of the very men. And they always said he had no clack.
Yeah.
So he could pour it straight down. And he used to stand, the grocery shop and the car driving instructor there at Marketplace, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, he used to stand on that corner of Dinkoff Lane, waiting for them to open the Rothman's Arms door.
But the Volunteers was going at that stage, wasn't it? Or was it, had it closed by that?
I don't remember the Volunteers. I remember...
That was
heard
in
them,
the 50s.
I've heard them talk about it, but I've been in the Birkenmen's Club, but not to drink. You know, I've been in, holding to the door and just peeked in and that, you know.
Yeah.
But Jackie Jones used to go in, and a chap called Harry Bracewell used to go in. I don't know, he was a bit of a character of Eden for a long time. He's in a home somewhere, I don't know.
What about cars? Did you have a car?
Me?
You mentioned a van once.
Yeah, well, that was the first vehicle I had. I must have been 40 before I had one.
What was it?
A Ford. After that, I had 5 or 6 Ford cars. I fell in love with Fords. I had a Ford Classic and a Zephyr and a Cortina.
But your first one was a Ford.
The first one was a Ford van. I mean, I had a relation up at Waterfoot, and he ran a scrapyard. And I went up to see him one time, and he'd done this van up himself. He was very good, and he painted. It was hand painted, and it was lovely. And he put seats in the back of this van, you see. Oh, and I fell in love with his mum. I said, oh, that's lovely, you know. So I rang him up a few days later after I'd been with all my dear. I said, what about selling me that van? Because he had a car, too, you know, about him. Oh, no, I'm not selling it. So I spent all this time on it. I said, oh, all right. He rang me up a day too late. He said, you can have it. I think it only about £120. But it was lovely. Oh, it was a cracker. Yeah, it was. It was a lovely van. I really liked it. And then I used it to transport people back, you know. And then I went to a car. But I've never been mechanically minded. I'm not, what I need repairs doing, I'll take to the garage.
You weren't involved with scouts or...
I was. We had scouts a long time ago when I was a boy. But I was never in them because we were too far away, you know.
This was down around Scotland, presumably.
Yeah. But eventually, when our lads was getting grown up, we had a priest came to Ranford called Father Reynolds, and he ended up Chief Scout for All England, not Chief Scout, Chief Scout
Commissioner,
Commissioner for All England, and he started the Scouts up again, and of course I had to be involved. I was chairman of the Scout Committee, and we decorated the Lodge Street, and we, you know. And we got them a hand cart and painted it up and put all St. Joseph's 3rd Ranfort of Scout Troop on them. Kevin was a deputy scoutmaster when he died. I was only 17. And his cousins were in. And as a matter of fact, I only got some photographs out for Trevor to have a look at yesterday. And this was 40 odd years ago. They used to go up Gollingrod and then...
camping up there, or
what? Yeah, they went camping up Gollingrod. And then they went to he came to our house one day, didn't Father Reynolds, and he said, I'm going up to Silverdale, something there too, and he said, I'm going to see him out of camp for the boys, you know. Would you like to come with me? I said, yeah, I would. So he took Nora and I up to Silverdale, and that was the first time we'd ever been there.
Oh, yeah.
And we got this site, which was, there was a hostel, like a hostel, and it was run by Catholic Brothers, and it was for one of the most weird-looking people I've ever seen in my life. Distorted features and all this sort of thing. They were awful, these patients. But they had massive crowns. And we went there and made arrangements to have this camp at a certain time. And then he took us to a lovely pub in Silverdale to have a meal. And we came away, and a few years later I got a caravan up there and I still got it. And every time Trevor comes up, we haven't been up very much lately, I'm going to get rid of it, I think. But every time Trevor comes up, he always goes to that campsite. He always goes around to have a look at that campsite. So with Graham, if he comes up from downstairs.
So they went quite a few times,
yes,
did they?
Yeah, some lovely photographs.
What
yeah.
sort of tents did they use? Bell tents?
They're quite a few. My wife made them a tent when it was starting quite early. And it's still going. I waterproofed it. You know, I got the stuff.
Yeah.
We bought the poles and tie ropes and everything. And it's about this length from the wall. And it's a hip, you know.
Get the ridge tent.
Ridge tent. It sides down. It's somewhere. It's down south actually. There, they have it down there.
So did you do much caravanning?
No, we didn't. No, I've only had a mobile one. I've not had a mobile one. I've always got a static
one.
I've got on the same side. It's a farm site. There's no electric on. We use telegas for light and heat, you know. But I put all fluorescent lights in and use car batteries,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. It's been a lovely spot. Some wonderful, wonderful memories of Silverdale. I love it. But I think I'm going. Well, I know I am. I'm going to give it up this year.
What did you do for holiday? Because it must have been awful because you were supposed to be painting during holiday.
Well, yeah, of course, I always got a holiday time, you know, I always took time off. Oh, we've been to Canada, we've been abroad a lot, we've been to Italy, we've been to Czechoslovakia. That's a shame, but it was a wonderful, beautiful country, absolutely wonderful. Been to Ireland. I went to Canada for 3 weeks to some relations of mine. Went to Niagara Falls.
But this is more recently, is it?
Oh, yeah, this last 20 years. Yes. 10 years since we went anywhere because...
When did you go as a family?
Very often to these camps, to Butlin's camps.
Oh.
Because the absolutely ideal for the children wasn't exactly what
Skegness,
we...
or...?
Yeah, Skegness and I think we've been to all Butlin's. Middleton Towers, the one at Morecambe.
Yeah.
We've had some very good times. The kids are. Yeah. I mean, we were all right. It was good. We never saw them. This is where Kevin got a lot of his tutoring for cricket. For originally, he had a good, very good coach from Worcester. I forget his name now. We have a big photograph of him somewhere. And he tutored our Kevin quite a bit at Middleton Towers in that chap. I think he instilled into him cricket. And then when he went to college at Bolton, Garfield Silvers was the coach for Thornley College because he was playing for Radcliffe or somebody in the Bolton Central League then. And he used to go to one or two half days at Bolton College, you see. So he had some good tutoring, really, you know. Yeah, we used to get up and have breakfast and then go. And we never saw them again until meal times. We always went in and they were there, you know.
And what age did they do that till? Till they were sort of...
Oh, till they were, you know, and then of course they started camping.
15
you know.
Was then,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, they went camping, they went to Wales and they went to France and, you know. Mm-hmm. Kevin went to Lourdes with a party from Thornley.
Mm-hmm.
That's another story, I don't know. Is that finished now?
No, that was 2 or 3 minutes that day.
I don't know whether you've ever... You know about Lourdes, of course.
Yes.
But you've probably never been.
Yes, I have.
Have you been?
Yeah, but not on a...
No,
not on a...
Not on a pilgrimage.
Pilgrimage.
Have you just been there?
Yeah, yeah. Just
have you been in the grotto? Have you gone to the...
You're pushing me now, I can't...
If you've been in, you remember.
No.
Anyway, a good number of years ago, after Kevin died, we started to... there was a couple came to live in Rotten, and they were very Lourdes orientated. They'd been quite a number of times. And they were business people in Manchester, but none of them could drive a car. So we got very friendly with them at church, and we took them out quite a bit. And we got on about Lourdes and all the rest of it. So we decided that we would raise some money and take children to Lourdes, which we did. What we did was that she had a wonderful projector with all the rolls on and everything. And the sound, and it was the Lourdes hymn and all the, and a detailed description of all Lourdes and all these slides. So we went round, I took them in my car, and we went to different churches all over the place, Blackpool, Markham, because people want sponsors, directly people got to know about it. And we never made a price, they just gave us a donation, they have a collection, you see. And I made a screen about 12 foot square.
Oh, big screen.